August. The hottest August on record. August 1st. Let the juggling begin. Cabrera reports, to make room we send down Andy Dominique. Since we'll see four lefties over the next five games, David Ortiz drops his appeal and begins serving his suspension for the bat-throwing incident in Anaheim. Millar's at DH, McCarty at first, and Kapler in right. Or would be, except Johnny tells Francona during BP that he's having trouble picking up the ball because of the afternoon sun further lightening the Metrodome's translucent white roof. So Johnny is the least DH-like DH in Sox history, Kapler's in center, and Millar's in right. Cabrera's batting third, which I think is a mistake. But in the first, in his first at-bat as a Red Sox, he takes Johan Santana deep. Then, in the bottom of the inning, he can't handle a chop over Pedro's head. It's a tight game, like last night's. Kapler guns Corey Koski at home, but Tech bobbles the throw, and Koski steamrolls him. Torrey Hunter goes back to the wall and casually robs McCarty of a home run. The next inning, McCarty makes a diving stab of a Hunter shot down the line. Manny hits a solo blast to give us the lead again, but the Twins use small ball to scratch back even. To lead off the seventh, Santana hits Tech. To get more pop in their lineup, Matthew LaCroix is catching instead of Blanco, and Tech steals on him. LaCroix wings the ball into center, Tech to third. Millar then hits a high medium fly to right. Center fielder Torrey Hunter races over to take it from Jones, since he's got the better arm. He's in position behind him, but somehow they don't communicate because Jones never yields. He takes it flat-footed, and his throw is up the first baseline, and Tech scores standing up. Pedro's brilliant through seven, striking out 11. Santana goes eight, ringing up 12. Though Pedro's thrown only 101 pitches, Francona goes by the book, bringing in Timlin to set up. Timlin gives up back-to-back singles and doesn't record an out. On Embry's first batter, the young slugger Justin Morneau, the Twins pull a double steal. Morneau then skies one to deep right center. It'll tie the game, no doubt. Kapler has to go a long way to make the catch, then fires a no-look throw back toward the infield. It sails over the cutoff man, Bellhorn, and Cabrera runs over from second to corral it. He must look up to check the runner, or maybe he nonchalants it, figuring the play's over, because the ball knocks off his glove, and he kicks it, literally kicks it, toward first base. On a real field, the grass stops the ball, but since we're in the Homer Dome, it rolls away across the carpet. And by the time Cabrera chases it down and throws home, Lou Ford sliding in safely, and we're down 4-3. Welcome to the Red Sox. Joe Nathan gives us an opening in the ninth, hitting Bellhorn, but we don't bother to bunt him over. Hey, why change now? Cabrera strikes out, lunging. Manny hits into an easy 6-4-3 turf job, and we lose a carbon copy of last night's game, wasting another quality start. On The Simpsons, comic book guy, a true loser, has a Red Sox pennant hanging in his shop. I channel him now. Worst weekend ever.
August 2nd. When I entered in this diary on July 2nd, we'd just been swept out of the Bronx and had fallen 8.5 games back in the AL East. Now, a month later, we're 9.5 behind the Yankees, who continue on cruise control. The Yanks don't have much in the way of pitching, but it doesn't seem to matter. They simply wail the tar out of almost every team they go against. The Red Sox are one of the rare exceptions, but they can afford to ignore us, at least for the time being. Who knows? They may not have to worry about us, even in October. For the first time this season, one team, it's the Oakland Athletics, seems to have a solid hold on the wild card. Footnote. But the great thing about the wild card, what I absolutely love about it, is that it is, by its very nature, a slippery beast. If Oakland slides into first place in the AL West, hey, presto, the Red Sox are wild card competitive again, only against a different team. There are baseball purists who hate the innovation for this very reason, but they would be folks who, for the most part, haven't been stuck with George Steinbrenner's bloated wallet for the last 12 years or so. We've lost both of the games we've played since the big Garcia Parra trade, but I actually don't feel too badly about that, even though both were of the tooth-rattling one-run variety. For one thing, both of our new players contributed to the offensive effort. Okay, so Cabrera, who hit a home run in his first Red Sox at-bat, also cost us yesterday's game with an error in the bottom of the eighth. For another, the Twins are very good this year, and I'd expect them to take 2 out of 3 in their house, just as I'd expect us to take 2 out of 3 from them in ours. But now we finish the year's longest road trip playing teams that are either sub-500 or close to 500, and here I agree with the conventional wisdom. This is probably the season's last decisive turning point, and I'll be watching these games very, very closely. For the next 2 weeks, it's not gonna do to just play 500 baseball on the road. I'm hoping we can win 8 of the next dozen, and from now until the middle of the month, I suspect this diary will be hearing from me often.
August 3rd. Mark Bellhorn goes on the DL with a thumb fracture after taking that pitch on the hand, joining Pokey, meaning Francona has more platooning to do. The press is on him about the logjam at first. How is he going to keep all of his players happy? I may not have much confidence in Francona, but at least he has the right answer. That's not what we're here to do. Last night, Wake won on his birthday, a quiet indoor affair with less than 10,000 guests. For tonight's game with the D-Rays, Francona pencils in the most alien infield yet. Uke at third, Cabrera at short, Bill Miller at second, and Mankiewicz at first. Dave Roberts starts in right for only the fourth time in his life and leads off, followed by Cabrera and Johnny. The new speed lineup does nothing, but Tech hits a 2-run shot, and Bill Miller knocks in 3 more from the 6th spot. Schilling, a new guy himself not so long ago, goes the distance. But the post-trade face of the Sox is just weird.
August 4th. I didn't know how brave I was, asking the Red Sox to win 8 of their next 12, until Jamie Parker, looking cool and beautiful this morning, in off-the-shoulder black, tells me that the Sox haven't won back-to-back road games since June. But they managed the trick last night. And now, instead of needing to win 8 out of 12, they only need to win 6 out of their next 10. That means playing 600 ball instead of 666, if you're of a statistical bent. Although I haven't kept an exact count, you could look it up, I hear old Case whispering. I'd guess we've got in the neighborhood of 55 games left to play. 11 of them are with the formerly hapless Devil Rays, and this makes me happy, because the D-Rays, after running off a gaudy string of wins, almost entirely against National League teams, before the All-Star break, seem to be subsiding into their former state of haplessness, and fast. Manager Lou Piniella rode his horses hard during the streak, ran their dung to water, my wife would say. And now they seem punchless and reeling. Tampa Bay management has done its part to destroy team morale by trading D-Rays ace and chief workhorse Victor Zambrano to the contending Mets, all of which makes me sorry for them, but not too sorry to take pleasure in Tim Wakefield's win 2 nights ago and Curt Schilling's complete game victory last night. Not too sorry to hope that Bronson Arroyo can complete the sweep tonight either. Although I doubt the Rays will let that happen. They ain't quite that hapless. I email Stewart. 2 in a row, for the first time since June. Schill gets the complete game win. Manny crashes into the left field wall, plays dead, arises and hugs the reincarnation of the Lizard King. Film at 11. Go, you old Red Sox. Lou Piniella blew his hosses out in June and July, and we get to ride them spavined old nags 11 more times before the end of the season. I'm hoping, praying actually, that we can take 6 of the next 10 to make it 8 out of 12 after putting the Twins in our rearview mirror. Go, you old Red Sox!
After the June swoon and the July drive-by, I'm a little leery. Who are these guys, anyway? I was just getting used to Ricky Gutierrez at short, and here comes Cabrera. I almost feel bad for Francona, having to glue together a lineup from these bits and pieces. Thank God for the Devil Rays. But eventually, we're going to have to beat the Twins. and the Angels, and the White Sox.
Francona's a dork, and that's true. But first we're going to see the Tigers, who are currently 50 and 56. I'd like to finish these six games at 4-2, and would love to be 5-1. Wouldn't it be great to get like 14 or 15 games over 500?
The Tigers have been revitalized of late. Dimitri Young's back from that broken leg, and their young pitchers have turned in some hellacious games, so we better be ready for a scrap. Let's not look past tonight, though. Francona may not know it, but they all count the same.
I just went to check the game. When I sat down to write this email, everything was okay. We had a 3-run lead and Arroyo was cruising. Now we're down 5-4, thanks to a Euculus error, more damn errors, and a Toby Hall granny. Stuart and Steven, said the old psychic dwarf lady, your nightmare continues.
And now Dave Roberts just got pegged at home in the ninth with nobody out, and we lose by a run. Congratulations, Dave. You made the Hall of Swame on your first try.
August 5th. Still, we almost got the sweep. Leading 4-1 in the seventh and cruising, Bronson Arroyo gave up a single and a walk. A Kevin Youkilis error loaded the bases for Tampa Bay with no outs. Then catcher Toby Hall, 0 for his last 18, parked one. Make that score 5-4 Rays, and it stood up. In the Boston half of the ninth, newly acquired Sox speed merchant Dave Roberts, running for Kevin Millar and egged on by third base coach Dale Swaim, tried to tie the score from second on a Doug Mankiewicz single. Footnote. The decision to wave Roberts home seemed out of character for the usually cautious Swaim, and more like that of his predecessor, Wendell Kim, known to the Fenway faithful as Send 'em in Kim. The all-or-nothing dash for home is always a thrilling play, but this time it went Tampa Bay's way. Center fielder Rocco Baldelli threw a bullet to catcher and home run hitter Toby Hall, who made it easy for the umpire, not letting the willowy Roberts anywhere near the dish. Mankiewicz got as far as third, then died there when Johnny Damon popped up to end the game. It was another tooth-rattling loss, especially since both the Yankees and the Rangers, our current wild-card competition, won their games. But Tampa Bay hasn't been swept at home all year, so all you can do is tip your cap to them and move on. In this case, to Motown, where the Tigers wait. We're 2-1 in the current 12-game stretch, and I'm still hoping to take 6 of the next 9. I know that sounds steep, but at some point this team just has to start setting some steep goals and meeting them. I email Stewart. I couldn't tell from the paper or the game if Swaim sent him. I guess he did. My son Owen says the same.
Swaim sent him, then said afterward that Rocco Baldelli hasn't made a lot of good throws. Only enough to lead the league in outfield assists last year, Dale.
It was a move reminiscent of Wendell, send 'em in Kim. A moment of desperation, a brain cramp. I mean, we could have had guys on first and third with none out. By the way, how many games has this team lost by one run this year? What we have here is a team that's so agonizingly close to being good enough, but not quite. You heard it here first. I don't think we're going anywhere but home come October. How I hope they prove me wrong.
I think he blanked, entirely spaced on the situation. And wasn't like he was sending Ortiz or the Dauber. Even Roberts' wheels couldn't make up for it. We're pretty much where we were last year. Just hope the bats come alive, the teams out west knock each other off, and the Chi Sox pull their usual swoon. August 6th. I email Steve again. What the hell happened with John Olerud? Seattle was in the cellar and figured they'd dump him and go with a youth movement, I understand that. But I thought they dropped him so they could dangle him in front of teams like the Yanks, hoping George or some other nut would pick up his big salary. Then I read in the paper that the Yanks grabbed him and are paying him the minimum $300K, while the M's are eating $7 million. What, huh? And Theo, in his defense is good mode, has been crowing over Mankiewicz's old gold gloves. Olerud's got a closet full of them, plus he's one of the purest hitters to ever play the game. So if we had to have a fourth first baseman, Dauber being condemned to the fifth circle called Pawtucket, instead of the crummy Nomar deal we swung, we could have had Olerud for $300K and the time it took to sign him, and then could have maybe gotten a middle reliever setup guy to spell Embry and Timlin, who looked tired and beaten out there.
Ah, but Olerud wouldn't have looked as good to the cannibal Boston press, which will never speak to me again after they read the August portion of my diary. And I don't care. I mean, do you doubt a bit that Mankiewicz and Cabrera were to some extent PR gestures?
But, and this is where my forehead starts to pulse like scanners, didn't we already have a great defensive first baseman in McCarty? And doesn't getting Mankiewicz now make him totally expendable? I just don't get it. Unless we're putting together some weird MGM production number where every utility shortstop on the team fields a grounder and throws to a matching first baseman for a grand ceremonial 6-3.
Amen, brother. I've been thinking this for 2 weeks. When we get Veritek playing first, it'll be the fucking hat trick. Orlando Cabrera is actually Cesar Crespo by way of Stepford. Yours ever, Ira Levin. Ted Williams disliked and distrusted the Boston sports writers. His appellation for them, the Knights of the Keyboard, was sarcastic and contemptuous. This doesn't make the splendid splinter an aberration, but rather the first in a tradition. In the current era, Carl Everett was sent hence from Boston with his ass on fire and the tag Jurassic Carl hanging from his neck. Manager Butch Hobson, never one of my faves, believe me, became known, sarcastically, as Daddy Butch. Pedro Martinez, a proud and emotional man as well as a wildly talented pitcher, has felt so disrespected by Boston's Knights of the Keyboard that he has, on at least two occasions, vowed never to speak to the media again. Luckily for fans, his natural gregariousness has overcome these resolutions. Dozens of Red Sox players, past and present, could tell horror stories about how they've been treated by Boston sports writers, who now serve just two papers, if you exclude such peripheral rags as The Phoenix and Die Hard, that is, The Globe and The Herald. The Globe is the more influential and by far the more vitriolic. Its most recent acid bath victim has been Nomar Garcia Parra. The story being disseminated by the writers, Dan Shaughnessy leading the pack, goes something like this. Nomar was never a team player. Nomar was a downer, even at the best of times. Nomar had a line in front of his locker to keep the media from getting too close. Nomar told multiple stories about his conversations with Red Sox management before the trade that sent him to the Cubs. Nomar expressed doubts about how much of the regular season he'd be able to play because of the injury to his Achilles tendon. This last is supposed to help we poor, benighted fans understand how Theo Epstein could have traded one of baseball's five premier infielders for what boils down to a pair of journeymen with good defensive skills. And yesterday, more dirt. According to the Globe, Nomar may have lied about how he came by that sore foot in the first place. In spring training, we were told, by Nomar, that the injury was the result of a batted ball. Now, according to the Globe, Nomar is supposed to have told somebody or other that the injury cropped up on its own. If so, yesterday's story went on to speculate, he may have confabulated the whole batted ball story in order to keep his market value from going down in his walk year. Because you can heal from an injury, right? But if your body starts to give out on you, that's a different deal altogether. And the source or sources of this story? Do you even have to ask? Not named. Little more than backfence gossip, in other words. Just one more yap of the fox who wants to believe that, oh yeah, those grapes were sour anyway. And by the way, that big deal shortstop all the kids love? What a hoser. What a busher. And if Nomar Garcia Parra tells his Chicago teammates not to okay a trade to Boston if they can possibly prevent it, no way, under no circumstances, because in Boston the sports writers eat the local heroes in print and then shit out the bones on cable TV, who could blame them? I'll bet right now Mr. Garcia Parra is feeling especially well-chewed. And why are the Boston sports writers this way during baseball season? So angry? So downright cat dirt mean? When they are, by and large, pretty normal during the other three seasons of the sports year, football, basketball, hockey. I think it goes back to the basic subtext of this book, that the Red Sox, like the Cubs, are the derelicts of Major League Baseball, ghost ships adrift and windless in the mythic horse latitudes of sports legend. That may sound sweet to the poets and to writers like John, lyric little bandbox, Updike. Footnote, haven't seen him at Fenway all year. But sports writers want winners. Sports writers want their bylines under headlines like Sox take series in six. And this 86-year dry spell just makes them furious. They won't admit it. Not hard-headed Damon Runyon archetypes such as they. But underneath it all, they're hurt little boys who have been eating loser dust for much of their professional lives, and they just fucking hate it. Can they take it out on management? On Theo Epstein and mild-mannered, bespectacled John Henry? They cannot. Those fellas do not put on uniforms and swing the lumber. Also, and more importantly, those fellas are responsible for who gets press box credentials, field credentials, and who gets to belly up to the post-game buffet. So, by and large, management gets a pass. Footnote. In this context, it does not hurt to remind ourselves that Globe ownership, New York Times ownership, and Red Sox ownership all overlap. In other words, they're all in it together. Time to put the tinfoil on the windows, line our baseball caps with lead, and check our phones for radioactive bugs. Except, of course, for the poor, unfortunate middle management schmucks who fill out the lineup cards. Guys like Terry Francona, Grady Little, Jimmy, family so poor they could only afford a single M in his first name, Williams, Daddy Butch Hobson, and Tollway Joe Morgan. And Nomar, him too, that selfish guy, that downer, that liar, that guy who took the money, ran off to Chicago, and left the kids crying. It's all bullshit, of course, and in their ink-smudged hearts, the Knights of the Keyboard know it. But Boston sports writers are, for the most part, mangy, distempered, sunstruck dogs that can do nothing but bite and bite and bite. In a way, you can't even blame them. They are as much at the mercy of the long losing streak as the fans who buy their tickets at the window or pony up for Nesson on cable TV. Sooner or later, maybe even this year, I haven't given up hope, even yet I am still faithful. The Sox will win it all, and this infected boil will burst. I think all of us will be happier when it does. Certainly, we will be more rational. Later, after a quiet 4-3 loss to the Tigers, I email Stewart. I admit it. After the third Detroit base runner reached with none out, I left the room. Simply could no longer bear to watch. And, between me and you, a lot of this really is just daffy, horrible luck. Derek Lowe hasn't been the only recipient, but he has surely gotten the biggest helping. Last year, the second two batters are harmless ground outs, and we're up 1-0. Detroit batting with a runner on first and two out. Oh, this is maddening. Why did I ever let you talk me into this?
I watched every dribbling, seeing eye single. That third base runner was a ball Cabrera couldn't get a handle on. Thank you, Defense Minister Theo. I also have no idea why Francona's got OCAB batting third. He's hitting something like 100. You've got to have some luck to win the close ones, and some defense, some speed, a bullpen. In answer to your earlier query as to how we've done in one-run games, we're now 7-15. Wasted a great game from Tech. An honest triple, a mammoth tater, and then gunning down Carlos Peña to bail out new guy Mike Myers, really, that's his name, in the eighth. 3 runs against Detroit? That's anemic. Come back, Big Poppy. It's worse than maddening, and I apologize for dragging you to the death prom. My lament as a citizen of the nation, like an injured lover, is why are they doing this to us?
August 7th. I've suggested that the team needed to play 750 ball in its 12-game stretch against losing opponents. Boston is playing the same old so-so, wake-me-when-it's-over road baseball instead. After three matches in Tampa Bay and one in Detroit, the Yankees have sailed over the horizon, and even the wild card looks, well, it still looks perfectly possible. But we look less deserving of it, okay? We look about a run short, and I'm not talking about the run we lost by last night, or not just that one. I'm talking about the game we lost to Tampa Bay by a run, and the two we lost to the Twins, each also by a single run. That's 4 1-run losses in a row. This team has played an amazing number of games this season that have been decided by one run. 22 so far. The only number more amazing is the number of them we've lost. 15. Let me say that again so we can both be sure of it. 15 games lost by a single run. At least two of those one-run losses were to the league-leading Yankees. And we had another of those bases loaded with two-out nightmares last night. Again and again this year, the Red Sox have failed to produce in that situation. Versus the Tigers, Kevin Youkilis did manage to snare a walk. He is, after all, the Greek... never mind. Temporarily tying the score for the tragical Mr. Lowe. That brought up Orlando Cabrera, one half of Theo Epstein's replacement for Nomar Garciaparra. Cabrera, who is pressing at the plate and looking more and more like a Stepford Caesar Crespo clone, struck out on three pitches, two of them well out of the strike zone, and that was the end of our one big chance. The Sox went meekly in the top of the ninth, as they have all too often this year, and now taking 8 out of 12 means taking 6 out of 8. It can be done, but I doubt it can be done by this team. I email Stewart. The game is looking very shaky into the seventh. I hate the way this season is going.
We did finally pull away from the Tigers tonight, but you're right. The way the season's going seems to be lose, Pedro, lose, Shill, lose. Except when Timme throws in the trop or Arroyo faces the Yanks. Or Lowe's every third start. When are we going to put together a decent streak? At least El Jefe's back. And don't you know Manny comes down with the flu.
August 9th. It was a good weekend for the faithful. Pedro Martinez won pretty on Saturday, and Tim Wakefield won ugly on Sunday. Footnote. How ugly? He was the first pitcher in 70 years to surrender 6 home runs and still get the win. The Tigers hit 7 long taters in all, the last coming off reliever Mike Timlin. The Red Sox hit 3, 1 from David Ortiz and 2 from Kevin Youkilis. In their current important 12-game stretch against underachieving clubs, Boston now stands at 4-2. Only a churl would point out that they could be 6-0. I am, of course, that churl. We have moved into a three-way tie for the wild card with two of the AL Western Division clubs, the Angels and the Rangers, and that is a marked improvement over where we were a week ago. I'll take it. But any longtime follower of the Red Sox will tell you that when the team's cheek grows rosy, the almost automatic response is for someone, either in the media or in the organization itself, to slap a leech on it. In this case, the leeching has to do with Kevin Millar's comments about his playing time and the constantly shifting nature of the team's makeup. Millar's peak over not being in the lineup for the August 7th game against the Tigers, "Here I am, riding the old Benchola," is just silly, especially since he ended up being a last-minute add to Francona's card. But pro athletes aren't known for their statesman-like qualities, and in other baseball markets, such comments usually go unpublished. If they are published, they're apt to be, can you believe this, snickered at. Not in Boston, though. In Boston, Millar's pregame grousing was treated by postgame commentators Tom Caron and Sam Horn as grave news indeed. The preachments of Osama Ben Millar. Footnote. If the more analytical and amusing Dennis Eckersley had been teamed with Caron, he probably would have given this part of the Millar fatwa, the horse laugh it deserved. The part of Millar's comments which was not addressed, either on the Red Sox-authorized Nesson broadcast or in the predictably anti-player Boston Globe, was his perfectly correct and uncomfortably astute assertion that this year's Red Sox team has no identity, and it's that lack which has so slowed the team's quest for a postseason berth, one we all thought would be a slam dunk at the start of the season. To be 10.5 games behind the Yankees with a team this talented is just flat-out ridiculous. The 2004 Boston Red Sox has no face, and it's not Nomar Garciaparra I miss in this context. Oddly enough, or perhaps not so oddly at all, it's Trot Nixon I miss. Nixon, whose intensity can be seen even in the dog-dumb ads he does for Red Sox Nesson license plates. Every time he stares into the camera with those burning eyes and says, "We think of it as a tag and release program, so we can keep an eye on you." I wish to God he wasn't on the DL. Never mind, Red Rider. When you coming back, Trotter? We may need you to pull our irons out of the fire yet.
August 10th. The key to every sport, to every endeavor in life, maybe, is consistency. And nowhere is that more apparent than in team defense. Football, soccer, baseball, hockey, basketball. All team defense is based on the premise that each player knows where his or her fellow players are and can rely on teammates to cover either territory or opposing players he or she can't. In the major leagues, this assumes that each player knows his teammates' capabilities and habits, a familiarity that can only come from playing side by side game after game until this knowledge becomes second nature and can be acted on with the speed of reflex. Example: pop fly down the right field line. First baseman fades straight back. Second baseman angles in from the left. Right fielder comes on hard. If the ball's high and deep enough, it's the right fielder's, since the play's in front of him. If it's low and shallow, the first baseman has to make an over-the-shoulder catch running away from the plate. If it's medium in no man's land, usually the second baseman, having the most speed and the best glove, as well as quarterbacking the in-between play, has to flash across and get it. Ideally, each fielder has played with the other two enough to know both what they're capable of and what they'll do. One right fielder may have difficulty getting in on a ball, Millar, the injured Trot, that another, Kapler, Roberts, should catch easily. Likewise, one second baseman may have no problem making a play in foul ground, Pokey, that another has no shot at, Mark Bellhorn, Bill Miller, while yet another has maybe a 50% chance, Ricky Gutierrez. Some first basemen don't go back well, Ortiz, Millar, and some do, Minkiewicz, McCarty. With Andy Dominique, it's hard to say, since he's only played a handful of innings at first, the same way Dauber only played a couple games at first or in the outfield, or Cesar Crespo at second and short, or in right, center, or left. And beyond simple ability, there's the confusing factor of personality. Some fielders are aggressive and dash after every in-between ball whether they can make the play or not, Manny, weirdly, while others hang back to the last second, letting others take charge, Kapler, sadly. Does Doug Minkiewicz have a good feel for the combination of Bill Miller and Gabe Kapler as they converge on a dying quail with men on late in a close game? For Ricky Gutierrez and David McCarty? Ricky Gutierrez and Dave Roberts? Bill Miller and Kevin Millar? Bill Miller and Dave Roberts? Impossible, considering how little they've played together. Minkiewicz is still feeling his way into the defense, the same way Bill Miller's doing his best to acclimate at second base. At best, it's guesswork. Multiply that uncertainty by the number of odd and new combinations in the field. McCarty in left, Euclid at third, and Orlando Cabrera at short, all vying for a ball down the line in Fenway where the stands jut out. Or Cabrera and Bill Miller going back on a flare with Roberts, Johnny, or Kapler racing in from center. And add in the memory of the seldom used Damian Jackson ranging back farther than last year's regular second baseman Todd Walker ever could and knocking Johnny out, and you've got a patchwork defense that lets balls drop. Part of the problem is injuries, obviously, and part is the pre- and mid-season missteps by upper management, never getting a serious replacement for Trot, loaning up on platoon first baseman and shortstops to no apparent purpose. But Francona has to take all of that into account,
and at least try to put a defense out on the field that can work towards becoming comfortable with each other. Until he does, we'll continue to be inconsistent. And to hurt pitchers like Wake and Lowe, who have to rely on competent glove work behind them to win.
August 11th. The Red Sox and the Devil Rays have split in Boston's first two games back at Fenway, and we're now 5-3 in the 12-game stretch I've elected to put under the microscope. The 12 games leading up to the stretch drive. Boston hasn't made it easy on itself, losing the first game of the final road series against Detroit and the first game of the homestand against Tampa Bay. But the Sox have managed to win their last two series, and they won again last night. Bronson Arroyo looks more and more comfortable in his role as a starter, and thank Christ he finally shaved off that horrible sand-colored thing on his chin. Tampa Bay's Toby Hall beat Arroyo with an improbable grand slam in his last start. But in last night's game, Arroyo mixed his pitches better and got more ground balls. Also, Terry Francona, who is right every once in a while, footnote, a trait he shares with stopped clocks, lifted him while he was merely toasty instead of completely baked. There is a difference. Today, there's a three-way tie for the wild card, Texas, Anaheim, Boston. And tonight, the tragical Mr. Lowe will lug his top-heavy 5.50 ERA to the mound against Tampa Bay's DeJuan Brazelton with a tidy little ERA of 2.56. This may be one of those gut-check games that seem to mean hardly anything at the time and actually means more when you look for the point where a team either started to kick it into gear or didn't.
August 12th. Boston kicked it into gear all right, especially Kevin Millar. Millar seems to have decided that if the Red Sox need identity, he'll supply it. In last night's game against the Devil Rays, he went 4-for-4 with two singles, a double, and a three-run shot into the monster seats, setting the pace as Boston pounded out 15 hits and routed Tampa Bay 14-4. The man who gave the 2003 Red Sox their late-season slogan, Cowboy Up, is batting something ridiculous like .430 for the month of August, .31 for his last 66. With numbers like that, he can perhaps be excused for bitching about having to ride the old Benchola. We have one more game against the tasty Devil Rays, today at 1 o'clock, before tougher meat comes to town. The Chicago White Sox, currently a game above .500. Boston stands at 6-3 in the current 12-game stretch, and if we could beat Tampa Bay behind Pedro this afternoon, we'd only have to top the Chi Sox once to finish 8-4, as I had hoped we would. Meantime, in the wildcard race, chillin', we have sole possession, for today at least. Later. After writing that, I shut down the computer and head for southern New Hampshire to visit old friends. He's the physician's assistant who has helped me with medical stuff in a dozen books, most notably The Stand and Pet Cemetery. She's a retired nurse who has reached a hard-won truce in her war with cancer. We have lunch on the patio, a lot of good food and good talk. Maybe only horror writers and medical people can reminisce fondly about heart attack patients they have known. We promise we'll stay in closer touch, and maybe we even will. Starting the 140-mile drive back to western Maine, I remember that the Sox are playing the rare weekday afternoon game. I can't find it on the FM. Nothing there but rock music and what a friend of mine calls macrobiotic talk shows. On the AM, however, I find it crackling through the static on WEEI, the self-proclaimed Red Sox flagship station, and I'm delighted to discover that Boston is winning handily. My man, Kevin Youkilis, kicked off the day's festivities, swatting one over everything and into the Manny Zone, a.k.a. Lansdowne Street. At the one end of the East Coast, Tampa St. Pete is girding its loins for the arrival of Tropical Storm Bonnie and the more dangerous Hurricane Charley. At this end, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays have run into Hurricane Pedro. He almost always pitches well against the D-Rays, but he hasn't thrown this well in, what? 3 years? 4? It's a hot, muggy afternoon in what Mainers sometimes call New Hampshire. Due to road construction, the two eastbound lanes of Highway 101 are down to one, and the traffic is bumper to bumper. A road worker points at me, shakes his head, and draws a thumb across his throat. It takes me a minute to realize it's almost certainly my truck he's pointing at, specifically to the bumper sticker on the tailgate reading, "Somewhere in Texas, a village is missing its idiot." All of this should conspire to put me in a foul mood, but I'm as happy as a kitten in a catnip factory. Pedro goes 9 innings and strikes out 10. In the postgame, he admits to Joe Castiglione and Jerry Trupiano that in his old age he's come to appreciate quick ground ball outs and 10-pitch innings as much as the K's. We're now 7-3 over the last 10 games. We need only to split the next two with Chicago to finish the dirty dozen at 8-4. And as of today, there's a game's worth of sunshine between us and the Anaheim Angels in the wildcard race. Best of all, though, the last few innings of the game lightened what otherwise would have been a very tiresome drive through heavy traffic. And I think that's really what baseball is for, especially baseball on the radio, which is, as Joe Castiglione says in his book, Broadcast Rights and Sights, the last bastion of the spoken image, or something like that. As old Case used to say, you could look it up. August 14th. The Red Sox didn't make it easy. That has never been a part of the deal with them. But they managed to finish the 12-game stretch that began on August 2nd at exactly 8-4. The opener in the current series against the White Sox was another one-run loss, and tonight's game began badly, with Curt Schilling giving up consecutive solo home runs to Timo Perez and Carlos Lee almost before the last notes of the national anthem had died away. But in this game, the Red Sox played flawless defense. The highlight was a sliding, twisting, skidding catch in foul territory by Kevin Youkilis, who almost ended up in the White Sox dugout. And you have to admire Curt Schilling, a pitcher whose face, along with those of Bob Gibson and Sandy Koufax, maybe, ought to grace the cover of the old-school baseball encyclopedia. Following the home runs, he surrendered only one more hit until the sixth. By then, the Red Sox had tied the game on back-to-back solo home runs of their own, one by Manny Ramirez and one by David Big Poppy Ortiz. Poppy came up again in the bottom of the eighth after Ramirez had struck out looking on 3 pitches. By then, Schilling was done for the evening, but still eligible for the win if the Red Sox could pull ahead. Ortiz took care of his pitcher, dumping one into the fourth or fifth row of seats beyond the bullpen in right center. It wasn't quite as mighty as his earlier rocket, but there was still no doubt when it left the bat. I have never seen such a big man who is able to generate such sudden power. Not even Mo Vaughn. God knows how long it will last, but Red Sox fans have been blessed to watch it over the last 2 seasons, and Ortiz may be having an MVP year. Keith Falk came on in the top of the 9th. My wife had gone to bed by then, and that was probably just as well. When Falk walked Chicago's leadoff hitter on 5 pitches, my state of jangled nerves approached real terror. It was all too easy to see this one slipping away. Falk took the mound with 18 saves, not a lot for a club that's now approaching the 65 win mark, and very few of those saves have come in one-run situations. Tonight, however, just enough of Schilling's tough man air seemed to linger on the mound to carry Falk through. After the walk came a pop-up. After the pop-up came 2 strikeouts, the last on a faltering half-swing at a changeup by Juan Uribe, and presto, dirty water was playing over the PA system. Pedro Martinez was first out of the dugout, giving high fives with what appeared to be a fungo bat. One final note. The Yankees beat the Mariners this afternoon, maintaining their bone-crushing 10.5-game lead in the AL East, and winning their 75th game of the year with August not yet half over. They are on a pace to win 110 games, perhaps more. This is more than unreal. This is surreal.
August 16th. 10 in the morning, and I have no idea who won the game last night. We're at camp, away from TV and computers and even the newspaper. The director usually posts the bare-bones scores on a wall in the dining hall, often with a synopsis of the pirate game. But today he's bumped them for the Olympics. Yesterday, anticipating this, I shelled out $5 for the modern equivalent of a transistor radio and listened to the Indians and Twins afternoon game from the Jake. But last night at bedtime, I couldn't catch a round-the-league wrap-up. We've been gone a week now, and this is the first time I haven't naturally run across a score. While we were at my dad's cottage on Lake Chautauqua, Wake's 6-homer win over the D-Rays made the Jamestown paper, complete with a photo of Tim A. The Buffalo TV News at 11 featured our next game, since a local family threw out the first pitch in memory of their son, a high school star and Sox fan dead of cancer, who dreamed of playing at Fenway. Most nights I'd get just a score, and then have to wait for the morning paper to fill me in. Though during one newscast after the Bisons beat Pawtucket, we were treated to the real-deal player of the game going deep twice against a skinny submariner wearing number 15, the elusive Mr. Kim. A straight score, lumped with others from around the league, is flat and paralyzing. If we win, it's great for about 20 seconds. Then I'm pissed that I don't know how we won or why. A loss is awful, irrefutable, infuriating, and terrible for about a minute, until I realize that I don't know anything about the game, not even who pitched. It's a mindless, uninvolved way to follow baseball, almost zero content, as if the game is just about winning or losing. We don't watch a lot of TV at Chautauqua. Getting only 2 snowy channels will do that. So inevitably, I fell a day behind, picking up the paper and dissecting last night's box score, looking for signs. Manny was finally back. Trot and Pokey and Bellhorn weren't. Cabrera continued to struggle at the plate. Bill Miller, still playing out of position, made another error. Terrible Terry Adams put men on, and Mendoza let them in, while Takatsu, the White Sox reliever, inherited 3 runners and stranded them. Even uglier, their 7 and 8 hitters combined for 7 RBIs. Sometimes it's fun to puzzle out backwards what happened, but even a box score is cold matter, a map to treasure already dug up. Stanley Kubrick, insulated in his compound in the English countryside, used to have an assistant here in the States tape the playoffs and World Series so he could devour them at his leisure. And while I admire Kubrick's taste and appetite, watching a game that's long been over and watching alone seems to leech the immediacy from what is essentially a shared experience. Ideally, I want to be at the game, reacting to every pitch and situation as part of the loud, honest-to-God crowd. Short of that, I'll join the far-flung and far-from-imaginary audience all across New England, watching Don and Jerry, or listening to Joe and Troop, or Yuri Berenguer and J.P. Viamon, knowing that when David Ortiz cranks one, citizens of the nation, from the capital of Fenway to the borderlands of the Northeast Kingdom and the Dominican, are hollering like idiots, the same as I am. A box score, or even a decent recap, can't show me what kind of location Lowe has, or how much of a lead Dave Roberts is getting. I need to see it now, before what happens, happens. So this is limbo, not knowing anything until it's already over, and even then not knowing the results from Anaheim or Oakland. All I can say today is that in mid-August we're solidly in the wildcard race, and possibly in the lead, and that from all evidence as a team we're having the exact same problems we had 2 months ago, the same problems, really, we had last year.
August 17th. I need to go back to the Garcia Parra trade again, and it probably won't be for the last time. It's going to be one of the big Red Sox stories of the year. Certainly the big story if this wounded, limping, patched-together team doesn't make postseason, or even if it does but doesn't advance. Footnote: latest victim of the injury bug is Kevin Youkilis, who suffered a jammed ankle at home plate after being waved in from second by Dale Swaim in the final game of the Red Sox-White Sox series 2 days ago. Youkilis was out. When we got Doug Mankiewicz and Orlando Cabrera in return for Nomar, we were assured by management that this was a lot more than trade mania, the equivalent of the crazy buying that goes on at the annual Filene's wedding sale. We were plugging defensive holes. In addition to that, Cabrera's .246 batting average was deceiving. He was a doubles machine. Right, and we won in Vietnam. Mission accomplished in Iraq. Mankiewicz, although not used as an everyday player by Terry Francona, has played solid, unflashy baseball for Boston. And no surprise there. As a Minnesota Twin, he's played on plenty of contending teams, and he's used to the pressure. Cabrera is a different story. Players who come from forgotten teams, and surely the Montreal Expos are the forgotten team, either blossom or shrivel when they come to contending teams and pressure cooker venues like Boston. Cabrera has so far done the latter. The press has been patient with him, but you'd expect that. In Boston, most of those guys shill for management, and while they have no problem making Nomar look bad, they'd love his replacement to look good so they can say, "See? He's great. Told ya." More interesting to me, also more surprising and endearing, has been the fans' patience with Cabrera, who probably helped himself enormously by hitting a home run in his first at-bat in the Red Sox uniform. None since, though, and his Montreal batting average of .246 has shrunk to something like .225. Worse, he hasn't looked like anyone's idea of a gold glover at shortstop. Last night in Boston's game against Toronto, the first of a three-game set, Cabrera racked up a pair of RBIs, one on a base hit and one on a sac fly. Then, in an agonizing, rain-soaked seventh inning that seemed to go on forever, he gave them both back, plus one to grow on, with two box score errors and a third mental error that allowed a run which should have been kept right where it was, at third base. Cabrera's hitting in the clutch has been non-existent. In the game previous to last night's, the final game of the Red Sox-White Sox series, Cabrera ended things by grounding softly back to the pitcher, leaving the tying run stranded at third after the Red Sox had battled back from a multi-run deficit. So in last night's game, I was a little saddened, but not really surprised, to hear the first scattered boos in the rain-depleted crowd when Cabrera came up following his seventh-inning follies, which turned a 5-1 Red Sox cruise into a 5-4 nail-biter against the American League's bottom dogs. The crowd wants him to be good. And I have no doubt that he is. No doubt that Terry Francona is exactly right when he says that Cabrera, who, unlike Mankiewicz, plays every day, is pressing at the plate. But I also have no doubt that the Nomar trade has already cost this Red Sox team at least three games it could ill afford to lose, and that it will quite likely cost them more unless Orlando Cabrera quickly finds his stride. I'm not man enough to predict that the Sox will win 8 of the current 12, but they could, with half of the next dozen coming against the abysmal Blue Jays and two more against the only slightly better Tigers. And they should, if they are to retain their position as the team to beat in the wildcard race, and perhaps even put some distance between themselves and the other contending teams. But the injury situation continues to grow worse rather than better. With Youkilis down, we were last night treated to the bizarre sight of Doug Mankiewicz playing second base for the first time in his life, and aside from getting knocked down once by Carlos Delgado, he did a damn good job. One final note. As the season wears on, I find it easier and easier to spell Mankiewicz. People can adjust to just a damn about anything, can't they? August 18th. Having said all that, let me tell you that no one in all of Red Sox Nation was any happier than I was when Orlando Cabrera finally did come through in the clutch, turning on an 86-mile-an-hour Justin Spire changeup and clanging it off the scoreboard in the bottom of the ninth inning last night, chasing Johnny Damon home with the winning run in the second game of Boston's current series against the Toronto Blue Jays. Fenway giveth, and Fenway taketh away. In the first game of the series, it tooketh away big time from Mr. Cabrera. Last night, that funky just-right bounce gaveth back, and I went dancing around my living room singing the gospel according to KC and the Sunshine Band. That's the way. I like it. Does this mean I think the Garcia Parra trade is suddenly, magically okay? No. But I was rooting for Cabrera to come through. Not just for the Red Sox, but for Cabrera as a Red Sox? You bet your tintype. Because no matter what I or any other fan might think of the trade, the deal is done, and Cabrera is one of us now. He wears the red and white. So sure I root for him. Thus, hooray, Orlando. May you clang 100 more off that funky old scoreboard. Welcome to Fenway Park. Welcome home.
August 21st. I email Steve. Guess who's back again?
Considering that the Red Sox have won 11 of their last 16, maybe you ought to go back where you were, and I mean find the exact spot. It was especially great to see Cabrera connect on that crazy wall-ball carom double, like something out of a psychedelic Pong game, to win the game Monday night. And then there was Big Poppy, hulking down on Lil Massa Lilywhite, Toronto's starter Ted Lilly, who plunked Ortiz on the hand. Too much fun.
I've missed so much. A friend tells me that in one game, Francona started Mankiewicz at second. Is he shitting me?
Nope, and Dougie played genius. It hasn't been Boston's best week. I firmly believe that this season's best weeks are still ahead of them, but we're riding our fifth four-game winning streak of the season, and if we win again this afternoon, the Red Sox will be proud possessors of their fourth five-game winning streak of the season. There's better news. I've lost track of all my children, almost completely, and I'm hoping that when my viewing habits once more regularize on that front, the child of Babe and the odious JR will be in middle school and developing problems of his own. Kids on soap operas grow up fast. August has certainly been the best month of the season for the Red Sox, and the team couldn't have picked a better time to get hot. There isn't a lot of wild-card competition on the horizon in the Central Division, but with the exception of the Mariners, now better than 20 games off the pace, the West is a shark tank. For the last week or so, all the Sharks, Oakland, Anaheim, and Texas, have been feeding on their weaker Midwestern brothers, and all of them have been winning. Footnote: the Texas Rangers have won 6 in a row and show no sign of their usual August heat prostration. One of these clubs will win the division. The other two, along with the Red Sox, are swimming full tilt at a door only big enough to admit one of them. I comfort myself with thoughts of the schedule, which will eventually force the sleek Sharks of the Western Division to begin dining upon each other. The Yankees, in the meantime, have finally begun to falter a bit as their pitching arms become more and more suspect. May I note, and not without glee, that their trade for Esteban Loaiza is looking especially doubtful. There are already trade rumors floating around. They've lost 3 out of their last 4. The one win and almost miraculous come-from-behinder against the Twins. And while I don't think anyone among the Red Sox faithful are counting on a total Yankee El Floppo, but how sweet it would be, I'd guess that few among us are unaware that the New York lead, which was 10.5 10 days ago, has now shrunk to 7.5. Still a lot, but on August 21st, 7.5 games doesn't seem like an insurmountable lead.
August 22nd. I'm addicted to the Little League World Series the way a college hoop junkie craves March Madness. Every game is high drama, and you never know what to expect. Tonight, we switch back and forth between the Sox and the Lincoln, Rhode Island team, and after a while, like the end of Animal Farm, it's hard to tell where one ends and the other begins. Both survive late scares. The kids' defense falls apart in the 6th. In Chicago, the Sox are up a run in the 8th thanks to back-to-back jacks by Manny and David. When Manny goes to plant himself under an easy fly, slips on the wet grass, recovers, then slips again, and the ball falls behind him. Timlin gets us out of it, and Falk closes, looking sharp. The Angels have swept the Yanks, and the Rangers finally lost. So we're 5.5 back in the East and a game up in the wild card. And the New England kids win.
This is terrific. We beat the White Sox again, making us 5-1 in our last 6 games. The Rangers also won, but the trade-off is that the Yankees took another drubbing from the Angels, and at the stadium, hee-hee. meaning that the New York lead is down another full game. Knowing that their team has lost almost half their seemingly insurmountable lead in the space of a week cannot make Yankee fans happy. That lead probably is insurmountable, but north of Hartford, the only thing we love more than seeing the Pinstripers have a bad week is seeing them have two bad weeks. The Red Sox have scored 20 runs against the White Sox in the last two games. Varitek is thumping the ball, and so is Millar. But I think the big offensive story in Chicago has been Manny Ramirez. He's been sluggish at the plate since the All-Star break, but in the last two games, he's shown a return to the batting brilliance that made him such a catch for us in the first place. He hit the 16th grand slam of his career in the second inning of the Friday night game, August 20th, and added a three-run job yesterday. He has a total of 9 RBIs in the two games. To this, you should add in Manny's glove work, especially back home in Boston, where he has become more and more comfortable with the eccentricities of left field at Fenway, a position that has made strong baseball players cry. Manny has gotten a reputation as a bad defensive baseball player and will almost certainly carry it with him for his entire career. The only people less likely than baseball fans to change their minds about a player are other players, coaches, and, of course, Ted Williams's Knights of the Keyboard. But he has mastered the knack of playing the carom off the Green Monster in such a way as to hold runners at first, the world-famous wall ball single. And he has made some brilliant, fearless catches, especially going to his right, into the Twilight Zone territory beyond third base, where the wall is hard and foul territory is measured in mere inches. He's no Yaz, but is he at least the equal of Mike Greenwell and maybe a little better? Our survey says yes. And damn, ain't he a likable cuss. That wasn't always the case in Cleveland, where Manny had a reputation for taciturnity. He rarely did interviews, standoffishness, and laziness. In Boston, Manny always seems to be smiling, and it is a beautiful smile, boyish and somehow innocent. He hustles, and the camera frequently catches him goofing with his teammates in the dugout. In one beautifully existential contrast, the viewer sees Curt Schilling studiously poring over paperwork while Manny mugs crazily over his shoulder. He has even done a shoe commercial, which has its own brand of goofy Manny Ramirez charm. Footnote: in it, Dreamy Manny fantasizes about becoming the World Series MVP. Some of the change from Growly Manny to Don't Worry, Be Happy Manny may have to do with the Dominican Mafia that simply by chance now surrounds him. Cheery by nature players like Pedro Martinez and David Ortiz. Some of it may be a kind of weird alchemy in Manny's lungs. He pulls in the baleful, media-poisoned air of Boston and exhales his own brand of nonchalant good cheer in its place. I actually sort of buy this, because not even the trade rumors that swirled around him in the off-season changed Manny as we have come to know him. He comes to work, he does his job, and if the Red Sox win, he gives a post-game interview in which he shakes his head and says, "We gotta just keep going, man, you know? We got another season in the season, and we gotta just keep going." One of the reasons I'd like the Red Sox to win the World Series is so I can see if Manny would say, "We gotta just keep going, man," in his post-game interview. If he's that much on cruise control. Probably not, but I'm sure he'd smile, and that smile is worth $1,000. I email Stewart. "Admit it. You stole the scream. It reminded you of how you felt in Game 7 versus the Yankees in last year's ALCS.
"I stole it and shipped it to Billy Buck, who's staring at it right now, nailed up on the wall of his shack in deepest Aryan, Idaho. Edvard Munk was a Sox fan, a Chi Sox fan. Talk about tanking. They were in first on July 26th. Since then, they've gone 8-19. It's not that the Twins have played great ball. It's just a flat-out collapse. When's the last time we swept them in Comiskey?"
"Been quite a few years. It's nice to feel happy again about the Red Sox, isn't it? If only for a while."
"You were dead right about how nice it would be getting 15 games over 500. But I sure didn't count on the A's, Rangers, and Angels all streaking alongside of us. There's four cars, and the tunnel is only two lanes.
All is well as can be here, and Manny is stroking the shit out of the ball. Check out Chip McGrath's Lost Cause piece in today's New York Times magazine. Good for a giggle, I think. Or a snort of disgust.
I expect it's about the Yanks' El Foldo act, the last three, make it 4 years running.
Can you believe the Yankees lost 5 games in 1 week? I went to bed thinking, if I was Joe Torre, I'd say, this is why you like the big lead. You can go through a tough stretch like this and still be on top. I got up this morning and damned if that wasn't just what the skip said. What our skip said was that when Manny dropped the pop, he swallowed half his plug of tobacco. Served him right.
Old Joe's got the luxury of a 6-man rotation and all the bench support George can buy, so he doesn't have to sweat September. October, though? If they choke again, there are going to be some changes. Imagine if the heavily favored Sox blew 3 consecutive postseasons. Why, there'd be talk of a curse. I'd like to see a reel with all of Manny's wild lights. He's like Charlie Brown out there, or Pigpen. And I ain't going to say it, but you know what that plug of chaw resembles half in and half out of Terry's mouth? Are you?
My last bit in the August section is about Manny. Manny at the bat and Manny in the field. And how his bad fielding is a misperception. I think you'll be amused.
I'm sure it'll be a hoot. Wonder if we'll agree. Manny's about style, and I can dig that. But sometimes that feigned nonchalance leads to real goofs. Like not running out pops down the line that end up falling fair. Or forgetting how many outs there are. He's got a good arm, but he loves to do that cool, no-look throw from the corner so much that often he doesn't get enough zip on the ball and ends up rainbowing one in. And of course, my favorite was when he forgot to call time after a double, stepped off second, and got tagged out. But hey, it's all part of being Manny.
August 23rd. I email Stewart. In the Times piece about the Yankees' lost weekend, there is, so help me God, this line. Meanwhile, the Red Sox loom. So take that, Chip McGrath.
Kurt Schilling calls the Lincoln, Rhode Island Little League team to give them a pep talk before their game tonight. The kids and their coaches are gathered around a speakerphone on a table. Everyone's pumped. Are you going to win it? Schill asks. Yeah, everyone says. And then one kid, a skinny little joker, leans over the phone and asks, are you? Just as the room busts up, there's no more explosive laughter than nervous laughter. Vincent Price, Mask of the Red Death laughter. The ESPN crawl at the bottom of the screen reads, Garcia Parra, Chicago NL, out with strained wrist. The advantage we have in the wild card is that with the unbalanced schedule, the teams in the West will be facing one another, while we feast on scrubs like the Jays and D-Rays. Tonight we plan to cash in, throwing Pedro against Ted Lilly in the mostly empty Sky Dome. Reed Johnson leads off the Toronto first with a home run. Orlando Hudson follows with a triple. Again, Pedro's come out like his brother Ramon, as if he's not warmed up to game speed. He settles down after that and throws a great game, only giving up 2 more hits. But Lilly's on, and with our lack of righty power, and Tech serving his suspension for shoving A-Rod, he shuts us down 3-0. A 3-hit complete game. Only the second shutout against us. Jason Schmitz is the other. The Yanks beat Cleveland on a Sterry Sheffield home run, and the Angels won to pull even with us. And the kids from Rhode Island lost.
August 24th. This is a true adventure in surrealism. I'm in Boston, exploring possibilities for a musical play with John Mellencamp, and the Red Sox are in Toronto, exploring possibilities for extending their season into October. Tim Wakefield, the pitcher who's closest to the center of this Red Sox fan's heart, is on the hill, and I keep running out to check with Ray, my longtime limo driver, who's parked in a loading zone and listening to the game on the radio. At first, things don't go well. For most of the season, Wakefield's had problems with the gopher ball, and he gives up another in the first. The Jays keep pecking, and are leading 3-0 when the Red Sox begin to crawl back, courtesy of Manny, we gotta just keep going, man, Ramirez, who plates a couple with a base hit to center. Then Doug Mirabelli, who regularly catches Wakefield and will be standing in for Jason Varitek this week while Tech finishes serving his 4-game suspension for the brawl with Alex Rodriguez, hits a monster 3-run homer to left center, putting the Sox up 5-3. I'm headed back to my hotel with Ray when Wake leaves the game. At that point, the Red Sox still lead by 2, but the Blue Jays have loaded the bases with nobody out. Enter Mike Timlin, who strikes out 2, and then we lose WEEI's AM signal amid the tall buildings. Ray and I sit, not speaking, at a seemingly endless red light, listening to static. When we get rolling again, and the static finally clears, I hear the merry voices of the giant glass singers. Who do you call when your windshield's busted? And know that Timlin either gave up a disastrous multi-base hit and is being replaced, the barn door securely locked by Terry Francona after the horse has been stolen, or he actually wriggled out of it. When the game comes back on, the Red Sox are batting. It turns out that Timlin coaxed Alex Rios, the third batter to face him, into hitting a mild ground ball. Ray and I slap hands and we're back at the Boston Harbor Hotel before the Red Sox have finished batting. I rush upstairs, ready to watch the final inning of what turns out to be another one-run nail-biter on TV, only to discover that the Boston Harbor may be the only hotel in the Boston metro area that doesn't carry Nesson. No Red Sox on TV, in other words. I try the radio. Nothing on the FM but opera and Aerosmith. Nothing on the AM band but one constant blat of static. I do the only reasonable thing under the circumstances. I call my son in New Hampshire and have him call the final 3 batters, Joe Castiglione style, over the phone. It feels like bad mojo. The Red Sox always seem to lose when I watch or listen with my kids. But this time, the Sox hold on, and I go to bed happy even though the Yankees have turned relentless again. We're now 7-2 over the last 9 games, and it's hard to be unhappy with that.
Top of the 6th, down 3-2 with 2 on and 1 out for Doug Mirabelli against a tiring Miguel Batista. Doug's the slowest guy in the team, a real double play threat. The book here is to pinch hit a lefty, and we've got a whole bench full. Problem is, with Tech still out and Theo and Francona not wanting to waste a roster spot on Andy Dominique, our backup catcher is Doug Minkiewicz. Mirabelli stands in and crashes a 3-run bomb off the scoreboard in left center. How does that proverb go? Some have greatness thrust upon them. Same thing in the bottom of the inning, when the Jays load the bases with none out. Embry's arm is dead from overwork, and Liscanic and Adams have had control problems. Mike Timlin's thrown way too many innings lately, but Francona's got no one else. Timlin goes to the slider and whips Reed Johnson and Orlando Hudson, then gets Alex Rios on a force out. He gives one back in the 7th, but Mendoza, another unlikely hero, gets 2 outs in the 8th, and Fulk handles things from there. So, thanks to some clutch play from the shallow end of the depth chart, we keep pace. August 25th. With Nomar gone and Trot possibly lost for the season, we don't have a true number 5 hitter to protect Manny and David. Francona's tried a number of guys there lately, just as he tried Dauber and Tech early in the season. When he posts the lineup for our 19th and final game of the season against Toronto, Bellhorn sees that Bill Miller's in the number 5 slot and jokes, "Are we trying tonight?" Dave Wallace likes to say that if your 8 best pitchers throw 80% of your innings, you'll be in good shape. That's great if you have 8 good pitchers. Toronto has 2. Kid righty Josh Towers implodes in the 5th, giving up back-to-back jobs to Manny and David. And then, 2 batters later, a 2-run shot to Cabrera on a hanging curve. Schilling goes 6 1/3 and leaves with the score a comfortable 10-1, giving Francona a chance to use some of our worst arms. Terry Adams, Mike Myers, Mendoza, who actually throws well, and rest the real pen for one night. The Yanks and Rangers lose, but the Angels put up 21 runs against the Royals to stay even in the wild card. Next Tuesday, we start a 9-game stretch against the Angels, Rangers, and A's. If we can go 6-3 or better, we're looking at the playoffs. August 26th. You never take the field expecting to lose, but when your number 5 starter is on the mound, you know you've got to work a little harder. Number 5 guys can be kids on their way up, Clemens early on, Aaron Seeley, Casey Fossum, vets on the way down, the execrable Matt Young, the puzzling Ramon Martinez, the scuffling Frank Castillo, the iffy John Burkett, or guys in the middle just trying to hold on, usually junk bowlers like Al Nipper or Wake. The recent number 5 fad is the converted closer, Derek Lowe, Anaheim's Kelvin Escobar, which makes more sense, giving a shot to a guy who actually has good stuff, as opposed to the normal borderline number 5 guy stuff and hoping he develops into a number 2 or 3. All number 5 guys have promise, otherwise they wouldn't be in the majors. But it's rare to see one over the age of 30 bloom into a solid starter, the way ex-Sock Jamie Moyer did in Seattle. More often, the number 5 who exceeds expectations isn't the vet or the phenom, he's already a number 1 or 2 like the Cubs' Kerry Wood or Mark Pryor, but a guy in his mid to late 20s getting his second shot and putting it all together, the way Bronson Arroyo does tonight. Arroyo's skinny as a stick, but he's no kid. At 27, he's been a pro for 10 years, signing with Pittsburgh out of high school and rising through their farm system, seeing limited action with the big club for parts of 3 seasons, until they waived him before spring training last year. He pitched brilliantly for Pawtucket, earning a September call-up, and threw so well, especially against the Yankees, that we made room for him on our playoff roster. This year, with Kim out, by default, he became our number 5 guy, and though his record's only 7-9, partly due to lack of run support, partly to our weak middle relievers, his ERA is 4.07, a full run better than Lowe's, just .29 behind Pedro. Better, in fact, than all the Yankee starters except Kevin Brown. Tonight he has his curve working and shuts down the Tigers for 7 1/3, giving up only an unearned run in a clutch 4-1 win. On the mound, he's contained but assured, then almost cocky, sauntering off after striking out the side, as slow as Pedro. It's the kind of performance that makes you wonder if he'll turn into a number 1 someday.
August 27th. As previously noted, the Boston baseball writers are masters of the bad vibe, maestros of dark karma. If cast away on a cannibal isle, I have no doubt they would soon be kings, at least until reduced to dining upon each other. Hardly anything seems to knock them off stride. How could it when they cover a team that has been denied the ultimate brass ring for 86 years? But one thing that does give them pause is a protracted winning streak. When Bronson Arroyo notched last night's win over the Detroit Tigers, he helped make the Boston Red Sox 9 for their last 10, and the Hub sports pages were flooded with sunshine, most of it thin enough to, well, thin enough to read a newspaper through. Leave it to Dan Shaughnessy to find a reassuring dark spot, just the right familiar note of negativity. In today's Globe column, untrustworthily titled, "Dark days appear to be long gone," Shaughnessy says in effect, "Does all this winning upset you? Does it leave you with a feeling of vertigo to get up in the morning and discover the Sox have won yet again? Blame Nomar." That's right, blame number 5, now living it up in Chicago under a different number. Shaughnessy dates the current role of distressing good times, "Ooh, my tummy hurts, somebody pass the Dramamine," from July 31st, the day of the big trade. Never mind the 2 horrible losses that followed on its heels, or Orlando Cabrera's terrible struggle to find his feet in the field and his stroke at the plate as he plays for the first time in years in front of a live audience. No, it's Garcia Parra's fault. And why? 2 reasons. First, because management pulled the trigger and management has to be right. Second, because we have just got to find the dark lining inside this silver cloud. How else can we define ourselves as cursed, for God's sake? I think George Orwell said it best in his classic allegory, Baseball Animal Farm Team. Orlando good, Nomar bad. Now, have all you little piggies got that straight? I get an email from Stuart.
You know how fantasists talk about the willing suspension of disbelief? After tonight's win over the Tigers, the 10th in our last 11 games, the 16th out of the last 20,
I'm experiencing an involuntary suspension of disbelief, knock wood. And yet, the Angels won their 9th straight to stay a half game back. Seems like we never have room to catch our breath.
Yow! Given the first 4 months of the season and the continuing injuries, who would have believed the August this team has turned in? It is unfucking real. September could be a fade, but we at least have a tame sked in the second half. Meanwhile, the series with the Angels, don't touch 'em, you'll blister your froggin' fingers, is shaping up to be mini Armageddon. I repeat, yow! Stu, do you believe this shit? It is too fucking good to last, and too fucking good not to.
I was thinking yesterday that the team has shown a lot of character, and I can't remember when there was as sweet and wild a chase as the one shaping up. Some real scoreboard watching. Way it's been going, I just assume the other three are winning out west. The A's are just as hot as the Angels. Damn you, Billy Bean.
August 29th. I recently read an interesting note from a sports psychologist. Can't remember who or where, or I'd be happy to attribute it. Anyway, this guy said that when the local team wins, they're we, as in we beat the Tigers last night for the 3rd time straight. When the locals lose, they're they, as in, can you believe how lousy they were in July? You can call Boston's recent spectacular run 11 W's in the last 13 games, if my math is right, as a lesson in just how great the disparity is between the haves and the have-nots in the American League. But that would ignore the so-so way they played against the same clubs earlier in the season. Footnote. Back then, of course, it was Nomar's fault. Even while on the DL, he was sticking pins in his Terry Francona voodoo doll. It also ignores the fact that we're doing it now, with many players either on the DL or going out there hurt. It's a great run, and probably Stewart's and my emails show this best. I hope you'll lay a couple of those Daffy suckers in here. Wabba wabba wabba. Do you believe this shit, Steve? And I'm back with Wacka 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 No Fucking Way. And to top things off, Anaheim finally lost a game yesterday. That means that when the Red Sox-Angels showdown, mini Armageddon, starts on Tuesday at the Fens, we're guaranteed the wild card lead. And if things go the way I've got them planned, that lead will be up to 2.5 games. Even the folks at Scribner, who commissioned this book, at no small cost either, have stopped crying doom, for the time being at least. I get an email from Stewart.
You going for the sweep today? Wakey wakey, eggs and bakey.
Shh! No wakey wakey. Just Tim May. No wakey them Tigers.
We won again yesterday behind a strong outing by Pedro. And this afternoon there's a carnival mood around Fenway. Manny, who fouled a ball off his knee and missed last night's game, comes out for batting practice wearing Coach Ino Guerrero's number 65. In the field, Manny's manic, flashing how many outs there are to Johnny, to the family section, to the monster. In the 5th, down 1-0, he comes up with bases loaded and 2 out, and the crowd rises, chanting, Manny, Manny. First pitch, he drills a single to give us the lead. Ortiz rips another, then Millar. Wake throws 8 strong and the party doesn't stop. It's strange, this high from winning, a straight drug, uncut. Faithful as the faithful are, we tend to nitpick even after a win. Not today. Everything's clicking. And sure, it's only Detroit. But we've won 20 games this month. The underachieving Red Sox have become overachievers, and no one is happier than the faithful. I email Steve. It was good and breezy, and Wake had his knuckler dancing. Just like yesterday, the Tigers hung until the 5th when their starter faltered, and then their reliever totally imploded. Yanks were losing, last I heard. Could we be only 4.5 back?
Indeed we could, and 1.5 ahead in the wild card.
Super sweet. Now, I don't want to throw cold water on the party, but the Yanks have a cake schedule the rest of the way. They're home 20 of their last 32, and we're the only winning team they face. Okay, and 3 against the Twins, but by then Minnesota will be resting starters for the playoffs. In any case, it's time to square off with the Angels. Some very large games.
August 30th. The last time Tim Wakefield pitched against the Tigers, he gave up 6 home runs and still got the win, a feat only accomplished once since the days when most big league teams rode to their away contests on trains. Footnote: the last time it happened was September 1940 to George Castor of the Philadelphia Athletics, who beat us despite 6 dingers. Yesterday, though, on a day so hot the pitchers in the bullpen used a groundskeeper's hose to spray the fans in the lower right field bleachers to keep them cool, Wakefield beat the Tigers again, this time more tidily, going 8 strong innings and giving up only 3 hits. No one was any happier than me. I hate to sound like Annie Wilkes here, but I've got to be one of Wake's biggest fans. Footnote: for reasons he probably could not explain, it's a fan thing. Stuart Onan calls the Red Sox knuckler not Wake, but Tim May. Hey, I don't make the news. I just report it. And why not? Look at all we have in common. Wakefield stands 6'2". I stand 6'3". Wakefield weighs 210. I weigh 195 and used to weigh 210. Wakefield's middle name is Stephen. My first name is Stephen. Wakefield got hit by a car while jogging in 1997. I got hit by a van while walking in 1999. When Wakefield started against the Braves in the 1992 National League Championship Series, he was the first rookie to do so in 9 years. When I started for the Boston Red Sox in the 1986 ALCS, I was the first rookie to do so in 10 years. Footnote: call this a lie if you want to. I prefer to think of it as a part of my rich and continuing fantasy life. More importantly, Wakefield is the sort of player George Will was talking about in his over-idealized book-length essay, Men at Work, one who really is a man at work. There is, well, I was going to write, there's little star-time ego about him. But in fact, there seems to be no star-time ego at all about him. He comes to the ballpark not full of primetime flash like Jose Canseco did, not wearing the ostentatious earring like Barry Bonds does, or with a panhandle-sized chip on his shoulder as Roger Clemens still seems to do. The Rocket still wants everyone to know they climb when he walks, by God. Tim Wakefield comes almost the way a man would come to a factory. Not plodding, but not strutting. Just walking steady, with his shirt tucked in all the way around, his belt buckle neatly in front, his hair, what's left of it, trimmed close, his time card in his hand. You almost expect to see him deposit his lunch pail on the bench before going out to the mound. He is the egoless workhorse who signed with Boston in 1995 after being let go by the Pirates and promptly won 16 straight for the Sox. Footnote: in a 1993 game against Atlanta, Wakefield went 10 innings for the Pirates and threw 172 pitches. In 1996, while pitching for the Red Sox, he threw 162 pitches in a game against the White Sox. Don't dismiss these numbers by saying, yeah, but he's just a knuckleball pitcher, until you yourself have tried to throw 150 or so pitches, even soft tosses, the regulation distance of 60 feet and 6 inches from the pitcher's rubber to home plate on a hot afternoon. I think by number 90 or so, your shoulder's going to be feeling like a turkey drumstick on Thanksgiving Day. He gave them innings, 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 including one harrowing stint as the club's closer. He was successful in the role, as he has been in almost all of his roles. But he was also almost impossible to watch. He became a free agent in November of 2000 and re-signed with Boston a month later, taking a $1.5 million pay cut to stay with the big club. Following his heroics in the 2003 postseason, when he came within 5 outs of being named the League Championship Series MVP, his salary went back to where it had been in 2002. Since then, he has again given the big club innings and more innings, keeping his mouth shut while he does it. Now, after various stints in long relief,
and that one scary 2 or 3 week turn as the closer a couple of years ago, Wake is back where he belongs, starting games for the team of which he is the longest standing member. He's run his 0-4 record to a respectable 11-7, seems to be rounding into stretch drive form, and if he doesn't garner the sort of fan adulation the Pedro Martinez's and Curt Schilling's receive, not too many people come to the ballpark with 49 Wakefield on their backs. That's probably to be expected. Working Joes, guys who keep their heads down and their mouths shut, guys who just do the job, rarely do. In fact, some guy once quipped, "No great thing was ever done by a man named Tim." Our Tim could prove himself the exception to that rule. August 31st. My wife's gone to see her parents for the night, and she even took the dog because I'm going to Boston. So I feel it's perfectly okay to give a yell of triumph when the Sox close out the month at 10:07 p.m. with their 21st win and the 7th straight, beating the Angels 10-7. The end of this one wasn't pretty, with Sox reliever Mike Myers giving up 4 straight hits, the last a grand slam by a late-game sub. But in the end, we prevail. Tonight, the Sox can be we. And even if Anaheim should get up off the mat and take the next 2, they'd still leave trailing in the wildcard race. And what puts the icing on the cake, the absolute perfect cherry on the banana split? The Yankees lost. Oh, wait, did I say lost? With a final score of 22-0. I think it would be fair to say that Cleveland administered a pants-down butt-whooping. Pricey mid-season acquisition Esteban Loaiza gave up not 1, but 2 3-run homers in the 9th inning. The question, of course, is where the Yankees go from here. When the Houston Astros no-hit them by committee a year ago, it served as a wake-up call. But that was earlier in the season, before their bullpen had taken such a severe pounding. Yankee starters have recorded just 1 win in the team's last 16 victories. Baseball has seen plenty of amazing late-season chokes. This could be the beginning of yet another. But the Red Sox players would undoubtedly say they can do nothing about the Yankees. They have 32 more games of their own to play, and the next 8 are going to be very tough. I hope to be at Fenway for as many of them as I can.